Let's start off with a quick experiment this morning. How many ladies in the audience own a pair of yoga pants? The audience own a pair of yoga pants. Okay, keep your hand up if you actually own a pair of yoga pants and do yoga. Have done yoga? One time? Okay. We're all hypocrites. We have the appearance of doing yoga, but we don't do yoga. How many people have a piece of exercise equipment in your house that you have never used? This was me for a long time until I got diagnosed with diabetes. I had a piece of exercise equipment, a bike that I had in my house, stationary bike. I had it for 5 years with every intention of getting on it. I moved it from Texas to Indiana, paid money to move it, and never used it until about 6 months ago. Good thing that I actually had it, but I was a hypocrite. How many people have running shoes but don't run? You go to Walmart, and I guarantee you look in the shoe section for tennis shoes, and everyone has a specific purpose written on the side of the box. I've checked because I just went for shoe shopping at Walmart. They either said walking or jogging or running on every single shoe that you pick out that's a tennis shoe. How many people actually look at the box and see what the purpose of the tennis shoe is and do what it says? I have a pair of running shoes. I have never run in those shoes, and I never intend to run in those shoes or in any shoes unless there's a bear behind me, maybe. How many people own workout clothes and don't work out? How many people own sweatpants and have never sweated in those pants? It's not for sweating, it's for laying around the couch. Then you're not even remotely going to sweat. Congratulations, we are all hypocrites when it comes to exercise. That we own this equipment, that we have these outfits, and we look like we're supposed to be exercising, but really we're not. And if you could tell my body shape, I am not exercising as much as I need to be over the course of my life. We are all hypocrites. This was interesting about the yoga pants thing. It's popular for ladies to wear the yoga pants now. The Wall Street Journal, back last year, or 2 years ago now, in 2013, they did a study on the sales of yoga pants and yoga clothing. In 2013, yoga clothing sales grew by 45% in the United States. Actual participation in yoga grew by 4%. That's a lot of people buying yoga pants but not doing yoga. A bunch of people running around on the street looking like I am doing this activity, but I am really not. People that say I look like this, people that say publicly I'm going to appear like I'm a yogaist, if that's even a word, but in private, I am not a yogaist. I'm a couchist. I love my couch. This is a face of what hypocrisy really looks like. Externally, you look like you're into something, you're into an activity, you're into yoga, but privately, not so much. And this is the face of what Christian hypocrisy really looks like as well. That externally, we appear like we are believers. We come to worship, we pray, we read the Bible, but privately, there is something different. It's like we're putting on an act. We're putting on a mask. It's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. We're living two lives. If we're to have genuine faith is this. And as somebody famous, and I've seen this quote all over the place and attributed to different people, so I'm not going to attribute it to anybody. The quote that you hear all the time is, "Character is what you are when no one is looking." I think the same thing applies for faith as well, and according to this passage, it's the same. Faith is really who you are when no one's looking. And the measure of whether we really have faith is not so much what we do here, but when you go back home and are in private, and even more so when you're by yourself, what is your faith? Had a deacon once express this to me once, and I think this is pretty funny but pretty true as well. Faith is who you are when you drop a hammer on your thumb. Faith is who you are when you get in a car wreck. Faith is who you are when you're in the hospital and you get a bad diagnosis. Faith is when you're going through the bad times, the rough times, the hard times, when you're outside of this place. Is your public faith the same as your private faith? Or are you putting on a mask? So that's the question for us this morning. Is your faith really who you are when only God sees you? We're going to start off in verse 1 this morning. And Jesus is going to give this overarching principle in verse 1 that he's going to apply to two different situations. It starts off, he says, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them." Literally, in the Greek, the sentence is, "Beware righteousness before people." Beware righteousness that you do for people is simplistically what it's saying. It starts off with the word beware, meaning to be continually vigilant. It's a warning to people, to believers, beware of this activity. And righteousness, beware of practicing your righteousness, it refers to something very specific that he's going to go into in this passage. He's talking about the three pillars of Jewish good works. There were three things that Jewish people, believers at the time, considered to be the pillars or the central attributes of what it meant to be a good follower of God. One was almsgiving, meaning giving to the poor. The second meaning praying. And the third being fasting. And Jesus is going to touch on all three of those things in this passage. So what is the warning here? What should we beware of? Well, the warning is beware righteousness for people. Beware doing good works only for the sake of people and not God. And you think of that and you think, well, that's awfully strange. Why would people do righteousness for people and not God? Well, we do it all the time. But there seems to be a contradiction with Matthew chapter 5, doesn't it? When Jesus talks about that you are the light of the world in Matthew 5:16, he says this, "Shine your light before all men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." Isn't Jesus contradicting himself within the same sermon at one point when he talks about the light of the world? Shine your light before all men so they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. But here he's saying, don't do that. Do it privately. Don't do it out in public. So what is the difference between these things? Well, the passage isn't saying that good works should always be done in private. The question that's being asked is, what is your motivation? What is your motivation? The warning is, beware righteousness for people. Is your righteousness, your good works that you're doing for people, or is it for God? That's the crux of the question. And in this passage, Jesus talks about two different types of sight. In verse 1, he talks about seeing. Beware of practicing your righteousness before other people in order to be seen by them. People can see our good works. But later on, several times, he talks about God seeing our good works. Down in verse 4, he says, "And your Father will see in secret, who sees in secret, will reward you." There's a contrast here between how people see and how God sees. You see, in order for people to see, you need to parade your good works around. You need to pull it out of the dark, out of the closet. You need to publicize it. You need to put a lot of effort into it so that people will see what you are doing. But how is the way that God sees different? God sees differently because he sees everything. And we use this in a positive sense, that he sees your good works. You don't have to put in a lot of effort to make it publicized to God because God sees it. But for people to see, we have to publicize it. There has to be this great amount of effort expended for people to notice us. This is not only true for good works, but pretty much anything. If you want people to take notice of you nowadays and to make yourself famous, there has to be a lot of effort to cut through the noise of the 24-hour news cycle. Something outrageous has to be done. For example, Weird Al Yankovic just put out a new album. He is an artist that was from the 80s, back from when I was growing up. And he was trying to think about, well, how will I get people in this generation to buy my album? And so for 8 different days, he put out a different music video every single day on a different piece of media to try to cut through the noise of people seeing different things in the 24-hour news cycle. In a time where people's attention span is minutia, how do you get people to pay attention to you? And he was able to cut through it, and because of his efforts of having this constant barrage of Weird Al, he had the number one album in America. But it took a lot of effort for this old artist to become number one in America again. It takes a lot of effort from us to be seen as well. What will it take for people to notice us, to publicize us, to get an article in the newspaper, to put ourselves on YouTube, to write ourselves songs? What does it take to be famous nowadays? It takes a lot of work. But to be famous in the eyes of God, it doesn't take that much effort. Because God sees. And this is one of the critical differences in this passage. And why publicity in the eyes of people, doing righteousness, doing good works for people, is so silly. Because you put out a lot of effort, and maybe one or two people notice you for doing those good works and give you an attaboy. But God, the one that really matters, he sees no matter what. So why are we putting so much effort in publicizing ourselves and the works of ourselves or the works of our church, trying to get people to make notice when God sees it already? And if we care about God, we wouldn't care about the publicity either. The publicity is incidental. Who cares if people pay attention to us? God knows, God sees, and this is God seeing in a positive sense. A lot of times with kids, we use God sees in a negative sense, don't we? Johnny, you shouldn't lie, because you know what? God's watching all the time, and God sees you. God sees you while you're on the internet and all by yourself. And we use God sees in a very negative sense, but this is God seeing in a positive sense. That when you buy groceries for that older lady, God sees you. You don't have to publicize it. When you go over to somebody's house and fix their sink, God sees you. You don't have to publicize that. When you give money to somebody in need, God sees you. You don't have to publicize it. Why are we spreading this around if God already sees? And that's the problem. Who are we doing it for? And if we're doing it for God, then we don't need the publicity because God sees it. But it goes even deeper as we go into verse 1 in this overarching principle. Beware of practicing righteousness for people. It continues on and says, for then you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. And here's the big question. What reward are you seeking? What reward are you seeking? Even as believers, there's lots of bad rewards that we can go out and seek. We're well-intentioned and well-meaning, but even believers can get off the track pursuing bad rewards. We can pursue money and be selfish in pursuing our own financial interests. We could be pursuing possessions. We could be pursuing fame. We could be pursuing our own reputation, making ourselves look good. In church, we could be pursuing numbers for the sake of having numbers. Are we seeking God as our reward, or are we seeking something else? And here's the scary part of this passage. It says, for then you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. And it reiterates this several parts, several ways in the same passage. The scary part of this passage is this. If you are seeking bad rewards through good works, then God will give it to you. If you are seeking bad rewards through good works, then God will give that to you. If you are preaching or if you are teaching to get money, to get possessions, to get a bad good reputation, I hope you're not preaching to get a bad reputation, for people to think a lot of you, if that is your end result and if that is your goal, then yes, God will give that to you. And you will have no reward from your Father who is in heaven. But if we were seeking out the reward of God, then yes, that is the reward that we have in heaven. Now, you may ask yourself, well, this sounds like faith works, that if we do this, then we'll get the correct reward. No, it goes to the heart, that if we've really been changed by God, if God, the Holy Spirit is in us, if the gospel is at work in us, then we will not be pursuing these things. We will be pursuing God, the heavenly reward. It's not an if or situation. So what is our reward as believers and what is our reward as Christians? If the bad rewards are money and possessions and fame and a good reputation and numbers and all of these things that we can focus on, what is the good thing that we are seeking? What should we be seeking? Well, we should be seeking God. There's a theologian by the name of Richard Gutzwiller. I'm probably butchering his name. But he says this. God himself is the reward of Christians. God himself is the reward of Christians. Often we talk about our reward in some unwittingly bad ways, especially when we talk about heaven. Oh, I can't wait till I get to heaven and we're walking on the streets of gold, or I have a mansion on the hillside, or I've got 40 acres and I can live in the good life. Oh, I can't wait till I get to heaven and my life will be great then. What reward are you seeking? And what vision of heaven do you really have? Because the biblical picture of what heaven is like is everyone gathered around the throne of God and worshiping God. It's a picture of people whose reward is God, seeing him face to face, and they finally have it. John Piper asks a great question. If you could go to heaven and Jesus weren't there, would you be satisfied? If you'd be satisfied with a Jesus-less heaven, then you're seeking out a bad reward. Jesus is our great reward. Our desire shouldn't be the accoutrements or the extra stuff. Heaven will be a great place, but you know what makes it a great place is that Christ is there, the one who rescues us and the one that saves us. And that's why we want to go, because our reward is being with the one who saves us. There was a soldier once, and he was off away at the war front, and he was getting ready to come home. He'd been away for several years, and he had a young daughter at home. And so he went to the toy store, and he hadn't really had a lot of time to get to know his daughter. And so he was looking through the toy store, and he wanted to get her the perfect gift. And so he was looking through the aisles, and he was thinking, well, maybe she would like this dinosaur? I'm just not sure. And he went through the different aisles, and finally he saw this doll, and it reminded him of her. And he said, I think this would be the perfect gift. And she's a little girl, and she will love this. And so it was an expensive present, and he bought it anyway. And he was coming home, and he finally gets to the point where he meets his daughter that he hasn't seen in years, and he gets off the plane, and he sees his family there, and they're being reunited together, and he bends down to pick up his daughter, and he says, child, I got this for you. I thought of you, and it reminded me of you, and here is this great present I've gotten you. And the daughter takes the doll, and she throws it on the ground. And she gives her father a big hug around the neck. And she said, Daddy, I love you. Was the daughter disrespectful of the present? No. The daughter just wanted her father more than the other stuff that came along with it. This is the point of heaven. The point of our reward. Do we want Jesus more than any of the other stuff that comes along with it? Do we want our Father as the greatest gift of all? And if we want something else other than the Father, then we've got to check our hearts. There's many reasons why we search out these things. It doesn't mention it here in this passage, but there's many reasons why we seek out earthly reward instead of heavenly reward. One is that we're in the midst of spiritual warfare here on earth, and that Satan is tempting us through the world to be drawn away from what our reward really is in heaven by consumerism and people all around us that tell us we need phones, that tell us we need computers, that we need technology, that we need cars, that we need houses, that we need the latest stuff. And so our eyes through spiritual warfare are drawn away to the world instead of God. And we must beware of that and be because Christ has told us to beware in this passage. Some of us are drawn away because God is invisible. And stuff here on earth is awfully visible and awfully tempting. And our reward at times can often seem intangible, but we've got to run the race for the prize, which is Christ. Sometimes it's just simply a fear of people, that God is intangible and people are tangible, and we fear people more than we fear God, and our fear is misplaced, and we must learn to fear God more than we do people. But I think most simply, even as believers, we have this remnant of the sinful condition that's within us, that until we get to heaven, we won't be fully glorified and fully purified and fully sanctified, that this remains with us, and we need the constant reminder of the Word, to be in the Word on a daily basis to remind us what our reward is, because we are tempted so often to go off track. Church, I guarantee to you, we've been talking an awful lot in small group about what it means and why we should read the Bible. If you don't read the Bible on a daily basis, you will be tempted to be pulled aside to the wrong reward. And reading the Word helps us to focus on what the correct reward is. So what happens to us when earthly things are our reward and not God? Well, we become hypocrites. The big H word. There's a lot of depth in that word, hypocrite, and as Jesus goes further into this passage, the word hypocrite, which Jesus uses, it's a common label for people attempting to use works to please God, but the Greek word meant actor. The Greek word hypocrite means actor, specifically a type of actor who wore a mask. Someone who is putting on the appearance. An actor putting on a mask to appear like he or she is somebody else. So this is the center of what hypocrisy is. Is your Christian faith just an act? And are your good works just a mask that you wear? Are you trying to fake it? To fake everybody out? That you really are a great follower of Jesus Christ, but in private, you know differently. That it's all a show that you're putting on, not for God, but for people. I would encourage you to know and understand that God sees you and God sees who you are. There was a police officer, and he pulled a driver off the road. He asked for the driver's license and registration, and the driver was confused. He said, "Officer, I cannot possibly see why you pulled me over. I was going the speed limit. I didn't go through any red lights. I went to a complete stop at every single light. I've been doing perfect driving for as long as I turned the car engine on to the point where you pulled me over." And the officer said, "I don't think so, sir. I saw you waving your fist as you passed this lady in the car. I further observed you getting angry at somebody else and making a face at that person when you passed them, when they cut you off. I saw you pound the steering wheel in anger at somebody else." And the guy that owned the car said, "Well, none of these things are a crime." And the police officer said, "Well, I saw the bumper sticker on your car. It says, 'Jesus loves you and so do I,' and I figured the car must have been stolen." Great example is when you're driving. Does your faith match the bumper sticker on your car? Does your actions match the advertisement that if you have one type of faith and then another public faith, it's wrong. Is your faith just a cheap slogan? There's two quick examples of this hypocrisy as applied to the pillars of Jewish good works here in the passage. First, he's going to talk about almsgiving or giving to charity, and then Jesus is going to talk about prayer. In verse 2, Jesus says, "Thus, when you give to the needy, sound no trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that may be praised by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward." Almsgiving was charity to the poor. This is one of the central acts of the Jewish faith that the Jews believed, and rightly so, that everything that's riches comes from God, all wealth comes from God, and once you die, it all goes back to God. So it's all on loan to God. And one of the responsibilities God has for giving us our wealth and riches is to take care of those that are less fortunate. It was written into the Old Testament law that when somebody was gleaning a field, that they would leave a remainder for those who were poor to pick up. And so you were taking care of your community. And so they had set up a system of giving to charity. And the way that they did it is that in the temple, they had these alms boxes where you would go and you would give your coins to charity. And the way that the boxes looked, they looked like 13 different trumpets. They set them up in that manner to prevent people from stealing from the alms box, so that you, once you put in the coin, you could not get it back. Jesus says in verse 2, when you give to the needy, this practice of giving to the poor that they had set up in the alms boxes in the temple, sound no trumpet before you. Now, it wasn't that the Pharisees and the religious leaders had their own theme music, or they had their own backing band, or announcement of things like that, but they would make a scene about it. I'm here to give. Everybody watch me. And possibly what is referred to there, this whole thing about sounding the trumpet, the best guess of what that actually means is that when you went to give your coin into the trumpet-shaped thing, you clang the coin as loudly as possible to make people notice that you are the one giving. It's almost like if the offering plate went around. You went, hey, everybody look, I'm giving now. Paying and drawing attention to yourself. They're loudly clanking their change in this box, and the religious leaders were making a spectacle of themselves out of their generosity. What does Jesus say to do? He says, don't do that in public. Don't make a spectacle about yourself. It has this exaggeration of what Jesus says to do. He says, when you give to the needy, do not know what your left hand know what your right hand is doing. That's an extreme exaggeration that's not technically possible, but that's how secret it should be. That when this hand gives, this hand, it's none of this other hand's business. Give in secret. Because if you're here knocking on the offering plate, hey everybody, look at me, who are you doing it for? Because if you gave in secret, if you were at home, and you logged on to the church account, and you logged on to e-giving, and you gave via the internet, and you didn't give in the plate, you notice who's the only person that notices? God and the church treasurer. And that's perfectly okay. Are we giving just to make ourselves known? Sometimes this gets taken to the extremes where you've been to churches or you've been to religious organizations where you give, and the incentive for giving is you put your name on a brick, and the walkway all to the church or whatever religious thing is going on, that the sidewalk is all filled with bricks with people's names on it. Well, if you need a brick, what are you doing it for? Are you doing it to give to the church? Are you doing it so that you get your name on a brick? Or the churches with plaques, or this is in dedication of this. There's nothing wrong with honoring people, but what is the motivation for why you are doing it? Is it for yourself, or is it for God? I heard a funny story recently, and this is a true story, that one of my friends, he went to a church, and when he went into the church, they had pews like we do. They were a little bit older pews, and he went into the church, and he was afraid of sitting in somebody's seat. Anybody ever had that fear before? You go into a new church, and you want to sit in somebody's seat. Well, he went through all the rows and all the seats, they had these plaques on them. where people had purchased the seats. And so he went and asked the usher, said, I don't know where to sit because all the seats have plaques on them, and I don't want to sit in somebody's seat. And he said, the usher said to him, well, the plaques don't mean anything. What do you mean? He said, well, another church donated these pews to us, and they had plaques on them, and we just kept the plaques on. These are people that gave in a different church. But it just showed the, and that's a true story, but it shows the humorousness of when you dedicate these things to yourself, eventually they're going to get torn down. And sometimes those bricks with your name on it, they're going to get worn down, or the plaque is going to get taken off, or it's not going to mean anything anymore. So why do it anyway? Are you giving for yourself, or are you giving for God? The second example that Jesus gives is prayer. Verse 5, when you pray, you must not be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues and on the street corners that they may be seen by others. The emphasis here is location. Standing is the normal method of prayer back in the time of Jesus. To stand is perfectly all right to have that posture for prayer. That wouldn't have been anything unusual. What was unusual is where they were praying. The synagogue, the central hub of the society, to stand in the middle of the synagogue where people congregate and pray there, or on the street corner. If you went out to where Walmart is and Texas Corral and just stood there and started praying, you think people would take notice of you and what you're doing? Or you went to the mall instead of your house. You decide the mall would be the perfect place for me to pray. Or in the middle of Walmart, in the movie section. Maybe that would be the best place for me to pray. And I'm going to stand up and let everybody hear it. Well, why are you doing it that way? Jesus' suggestion is the opposite. What does he suggest in verse 6? Don't do that. He says, when you pray, go into your room, shut the door. Just for extra measure, when you're in a room, shut the door. Nobody passing by can see you. Go pray there. And your Father, you know what? He listens to you. So you've accomplished your purpose. Why do you have to go out in the street corner and draw attention to yourself? You all have seen this in different prayer situations. Not people in a public place, but people that are using prayer to draw attention to yourself. The people that get up to pray and they speak normally like Bubba Jones, and they get up and pray and they sing like Shakespeare. Oh Lord, we beseech thee, and thou hast thy great time. And it's like they're back in the 16th century when they pray. Why are you doing that in order to present to people and not to God? God can hear you in any voice. Or you've been in a prayer meeting and the prayer turns into a sermon. Where he says people start praying and it gets longer and longer and longer and people start preaching. And why are people doing that? To draw attention to yourself. Anybody been in a prayer meeting and it's a clearly something that's gossip and it's fashioned in the form of a prayer request? Y'all just need to pray for Sister Jones, because Sister Jones, she's been sleeping around with her husband. And I know I shouldn't tell you this, but I just need to tell you that Sister Jones is in desperate trouble. And not only should she be sleeping around with her husband, she's been stealing from the bank as well. And did you hear about Sister Ruby? And it goes on and on and on. Why are you doing that? To draw attention to yourself and your own agenda and your own attitude. Or oversharing in prayer time. What are you using prayer for? And if you're really praying, why not go to your room, shut the door, and just pray to God because he hears you? What is your motivation? Now, does this passage mean that you always have to give to charity in secret, that you can't put money in the offering plate this morning? Does it mean that we can't have public prayer anymore, that we all have to go to different closets in the church and pray separately? No, it doesn't mean that. The key question here is this. Is there any difference between your public faith and your private faith? Your faith is who you are when no one's watching. That when somebody observes you out of church, they should be observing the same person as in church. There's a Greek scholar by the name of Kenneth West. And he says this, Christianity requires that believers should be open and above board. They should be themselves. Their lives should be like an open book, easily read. Are you easily read? Or is there a part of yourself that you're just hiding from everybody? That you're afraid of people seeing? And you keep it locked away. And the only person that sees that is you and God. And when you go out of your home and you go out of your room, you have a completely different act. Like a hypocritical actor. You're putting on a mask and you're trying to show something to people that is not true. There was once a church where there was a boys' class, and nobody wanted to teach the boys' class. And so a rather surly deacon in the church decided, well, if nobody else will take this, I'm going to take this class. And the man had a reputation for just being mean. And so he gets up in front of this group of terrified boys. And he gets behind a pulpit and he starts pounding his fist. And he wants to talk about the importance of the Christian life. And the first thing he asks the kids, do you know why people call me a Christian? And of course, there's always one smart aleck kid in every class. And he raises his hand and the kid says, maybe it's because people don't really know you. You'll get that one a couple minutes down the road. If what would people that really intimately know you say about your faith? What would the people that see you whack your thumb with the hammer say about your faith? What would the people that see you out on vacation say about your faith? What would the people who see you on a night out say about your faith? What would people say when you're in the hospital and you get the bad diagnosis? What would they say about your faith? When you're by yourself or with your closest friend who you trust, what would your best friend say about your faith? If you're alone in your bedroom, what would they say about your faith? I pray that it would be the same thing as when you're alone as when you're here. Because that's the type of church that I really want to lead. Get back to that definition of hypocrisy, church. Does your faith feel like a mask that you put on to hide your true self? Does your faith feel like a mask that you put on to hide your true self? Does your faith feel like a prison, and after you leave church, you're relieved because you don't have to pretend to be that person anymore? Do you feel pressure to be a good church person, but you're really ashamed that you're not, and so you put on an act for people? Well, the hypocrisy is unhealthy. If you're pretending that you're spiritually arrived, then you will never arrive. We've got to fit ourselves in the place of the gospel. And the gospel says this. The gospel doesn't say, put on an act for everybody and pretend that you are self-righteous. The gospel says this, that Jesus loves you. Warts, sins, and all. And he died for you in that condition while you were a sinner. It's okay to make the confession that I'm not perfect and I'm a sinful person. And it's okay to be that way and bear our soul before the Lord, because that's how he wants us to come. You have to realize that you are in the middle of a process of sanctification. That you will never be perfect on this earth, but you are a work in progress. So it's time to stop pretending that you've spiritually arrived. And let the Spirit work in you. I felt that pressure so many times before in my Christian life that I felt like I needed to put on an act for religious people, when really in private I know that I'm not measuring up to the act that I'm putting on. It's the biggest relief in the world to finally say before God, and before everybody else, I'm not putting on the act anymore. Lord, I am who I am. and I know that you love me how I am. I know that you want me to change, but I'm not going to pretend to anybody else that I'm not who I am.